At my last church, there was an older woman who I would visit each month. She was perhaps in her 80s, and she lived in a small shack back in the woods. A little dirt road connected her home to the main road, and this woman loved to make jams and jellies. She was prolific at it, hundreds of jars a year. And each jar looked very delightful. The jams were delicious looking, and each jar was wrapped with a little bit of white lace around the top. And if you ask her about her hobby, she would tell you about how her grandchildren would come and take her jams and jellies and enter them into competitions at both local and state fairs. And she would proudly show you all of her bright blue first place ribbons that her creations had made. There was only one problem. I'd been to her house. Even though she was shut in, she wouldn't let most people come and visit her because she was a hoarder. Her small shack, which was about the size of this chancel area here, really, was just filled with hundreds of old newspapers, empty coffee cans, rolls of wrapping paper, old Christmas cards, and all kinds of things that she just couldn't bring herself to get rid of. Her living space was really a mess. And I'll admit to you that each month when I visited her, she would give me a little jar of something or another. But I could never bring myself to try it. No matter how good they looked, no matter how many blue ribbons I knew that they had run, I just couldn't get past the empty coffee cans stacking up in the living room. No matter how great the jams might have been, I just couldn't get past where they came from. And when we look at our scripture this morning, we see that Jesus is rejected by those in his hometown of Nazareth. The people Jesus grew up with treated him like I treated those prize-winning jams. Sure, they had heard great, amazing things about him, but they knew where he came from. They grew up with him. And as we read this passage, it's obvious to us that their familiarity was a roadblock to their faith in him. Because they thought they knew everything there was to know about Jesus, they had difficulty believing in him. Let's look at our scripture today and take a serious look at our own lives. Could it be that we are living just like the people in Jesus' day? Could it be that we're so familiar with church, with God, with Jesus, that we dismiss his authority and perpetuate the dominance of sin in our lives? The short answer is yes, absolutely, without a doubt, we can. Now, the people of Jesus' hometown are not just dismissive of him. We see that they're really actively hostile towards him. I mean, how dare this guy, who is just like them, claim to be something more? The temple guards say of Jesus, "No one ever spoke the way this man does." And you can be sure that those guards heard a lot of teaching, and they probably heard the best and the brightest speakers of the day. But here, these words of amazement spoken are not of awe and wonder, but of shocked disbelief. For the people of the town, it's really a surreal moment. They're thinking, can these words really be coming out of this man's mouth? There's no way that Jesus could possibly come up with this on his own. It had to be given to him from somebody. So they start discussing among themselves, where did this man get these things? What's this wisdom that has been given to him that he even does miracles? Now, if we read carefully, we see there are two insults that the people hurl at Jesus. The first insult is when they ask, is this not the carpenter? Now, this is not just a descriptive statement, a question. It is derogatory. It means, is this Jesus not just a common laborer? Is he not an uneducated, low-level worker? Where in the world does he get the gall to pretend to teach to us the meaning of the scriptures? He's a carpenter. Not a rabbi. Who does he think he is? The people are filled with contempt. They see Jesus as attempting to know more than they do, and in their minds, there's absolutely no way that this is possible. Because Jesus doesn't have the proper education, and because he's clearly from the low working class. It reminds me of a bit of a joke that I heard about a bishop who was sailing to Europe on one of the great transatlantic ocean liners. And when he went on board, he found that another passenger was to share the cabin with him. And after going to see the accommodations, he went to the captain and inquired if he could leave his fine gold cross and other valuables in the ship's safe. He explained that ordinarily he'd never avail himself of such a privilege such as that, but he had been to his cabin and he met the man who was to share his room. And judging from his appearance, the bishop was afraid that he might not be a very trustworthy person. And the captain, he accepted the responsibility for the valuables and remarked, "It's all right, Bishop. I'll be very glad to take them for you. And for what it's worth, I think your room should be pretty safe. Your roommate was just up here and left his valuables for the same reason." It's easy to judge someone based on who you think they are, right? And the second insult that the people give to Jesus is when they ask, "Is this not the son of Mary, brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And normally in Jewish culture, you would refer to someone as the son of their father. David, son of Jesse. Moses, son of Imran. Michael, son of Larry. You wouldn't describe a boy as the son of his mother. It implied that the father was unknown, that he was an illegitimate child. By implying that Jesus was, well, a bastard child, there's no possible way that Jesus had the authority to teach them. Because in their minds, God would never use a person who had an illegitimate birth. See, this conversation that they're having isn't a conversation about a local boy making good. Rather, it's a conversation about the audacity of a local boy overstepping his station. If you don't believe me, just read ahead. At the end of the story, the people try to drive Jesus off a cliff. I read a story about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas when he was the judge of the Court of Appeals in Washington. And he drove his car one morning out of the courthouse parking lot. And as Judge Thomas was waiting for an opening in traffic, a man opened the back door of his car and climbed in. He gave the judge an address and asked him to hurry. See, this guy saw a black driver in a luxury automobile and assumed the car to be a limousine for hire. This man's offensive assumptions led him to make a mistake of mistaking one of the most powerful men in the country for a blue-collar worker. In the same way, here in this passage, the people of Nazareth see Jesus as a working-class hack. But in reality, Jesus is the God of the universe. Now notice they don't question Jesus' words. They don't question his wisdom, nor do they question his works. What they question is the source. They question his authority. They're not puzzled, scratching their heads. They're ticked off. They're not offended because he wasn't right. It was because it came from him. You know what they say, right? An expert is anyone who lives more than 50 miles away. And Jesus puts this in this way in verse 4. He says, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own household." We see the people's disapproval of Jesus and how it leads them to unbelief, a very strong unbelief. We see that their refusal to believe results in them missing out on phenomenal guidance in their lives, healing. And who knows what else? They completely miss the boat on learning and benefiting from the King of the universe. All because they think they understand it all. And how often do we do the same things, both to God and to our fellow neighbors, to the people we meet? For example, a woman was waiting in an airport one night with several long hours before her flight. She hunted for a book in the airport shop, bought a bag of cookies, and found a place to drop. She was engrossed in her book, but happened to see that the man beside her, as bold as could be, grabbed a cookie or two from the bag in between, which she tried to ignore to avoid a scene. She read, she munched cookies, and watched the clock as the gutsy cookie thief diminished her stock. She was getting more irritated as the minutes ticked by, thinking, "If I wasn't so nice, I'd blacken his eye." With each cookie she took, he took one too. When only one was left, she wondered what he'd do. With a smile on his face and a nervous laugh, he took the last cookie and broke it in half. He offered her half as he ate the other. She snatched it from him and thought, "Oh, brother, this guy has some nerve, and he's also rude. Why, he didn't even show any gratitude." She had never known when she had been so gulled, and sighed with relief when her flight was called. She gathered her belongings and headed for the gates, refusing to look back at the thieving ingrates. She boarded the plane and sank in her seat, then sought her book, which was almost complete. As she reached in her baggage, she gasped with surprise. There was her bag of cookies right in front of her eyes. "If mine are here," she moaned in despair, "then the others were his, and he tried to share." Too late to apologize, she sighed with grief that she was the rude one, the ingrate, the thief. Be careful about what you think you know and where you place your faith. The assumptions that we make are only as good as the facts and experiences that led us to those conclusions. But faith is different than assumptions, right? Faith is going out on a ledge in spite of what you think you know. That's what the people of Nazareth lacked. What they thought they knew blinded them from what they could have learned. One summer, a drought threatened a crop in a small town. On a hot, dry Sunday, the village pastor told his congregation, "There isn't anything that will save us except to believe in the power of Jesus and pray for rain. Go home, pray, believe, and come back next Sunday ready to thank God for sending rain." And the people did as they were told, and they returned to church the following Sunday. But as soon as the pastor saw them, he was furious. "We can't worship today. You do not yet believe." But they said, but we prayed, and we reflected, and we do believe." "Believe?" he responded. "Then where are your umbrellas?" This story applies to all of us, really. There are those people who leave their umbrellas at home. Throughout their lives, they are merely hoping that their prayers will bear fruits, but they expect little. Others seem to expect that their dreams and desires will come to pass. It's as if they journey through life always prepared for something big to happen. And today, how will you approach that which you're yearning for? Will you expect that your prayers will work and bring about the hoped-for results? Will you bring your umbrella? Will you believe in Jesus, or have you grown so used to him that your relationship with him is just kind of commonplace? Our God is a God of miracles. We need Jesus to bring peace to our world. We see it in the news every day. We need him to restore our marriages, to bring relief to our economy, to do astounding things in our congregation, to make us the people that we need to be. Can Jesus do a miracle in our world? Can he do a miracle here in this congregation? Can he do a miracle in your very life? Only you can answer that question. We said it last week, and we'll say it again. Do not fear, only believe. Faith makes great things happen.